Session number 12246, Lieutenant Colonel W. Waitman, Reel 14.
Colonel W.A. Waitman, Reel 14.
This hand-to-hand fight was... The sounds were very graphic and spectacular. And Bowman of B Company grappling with the second Jap who had hit him on the nose with his sword, fortunately stood in his scabbard, grappled with him and felt a bayonet, realised the Jap also had a bayonet on his belt. Bowman whipped the bayonet out and stabbed him repeatedly with it, and we could hear the sound effects coming over the still night air. Die, you bastard! Die, you bastard! Die, you bastard! Thereafter, silence. The following morning, I went to get hold of one of my friends, Lieutenant Frank Hiles, commander of the Battalion Headquarters Defence Platoon, who I knew carried a camera, and we beetled off down the road a quarter of a mile to the scene, and one or two interested parties were already there, and naturally we were complimenting Private Bowman and his colleague on their efforts the night before, and we dragged the bikes to the edge of their position, and the bodies were already there, the one with his skull smashed in and the other one stabbed to death, and photographed Bowman and his colleague with their arms folded and the two dead nips and bikes in front of them. Frank Hiles sent this and other films off at developing but never got them back, so presumably they were picked up through censorship and mail back at some safe abode like Calcutta where the base wallers lurked. But I must say, it was a very good bit of work, that. The half-grown Alsatian dog was adopted by Sergeant Major Gunn of B Company and looked after thereafter. Round about this time, probably the same day, Major Shuttle sent for me and said that a further quarter to half mile down the road, there were some buildings which were probably a school, perhaps run by mission, but we didn't know. We knew there'd be no civilians there, but we weren't to know whether the enemy were there. Would I take a patrol and find out? So I got a small patrol together and went out through the battalion position and then passed through B Company at this long stop roadblock and then crossed off the road into the trees between the B Company position and these buildings. I took the lead of the patrol and went very, very cautiously down a footpath. When I got within a relatively short distance from the buildings, although I couldn't see them, I'd had a good look at them from the road before going into the trees, and it sounds as if we were taking undue care and caution, but over such a short distance of a patrol, but in close country, which it was off the road, you just don't know when you're going to be on the end of the foresight of someone's rifle or light machine gun. So you do move very, very carefully and keep open now, but within visual distance of each other. I then saw a pole with some Japanese writing on, and the ground round about it had been dug over. And I didn't know what that was, but except that it was a pole with Japanese writing in on. Retrospectively, it could well have been a Japanese grave, but it was about a diameter of 12 or 15 yards, so it was quite a large round area that had been dug over. I proceeded further down this very narrow footpath, just worn by either barefooted Burmans or a few Japanese, and I came upon some very fresh red blood in splodges. And with the heat of the day, it was very early afternoon, I think around about 1 o'clock, I realised that someone had passed that way, had been wounded very, very, not very far in front of me, because the blood was crimson and in splodges. So I went ultra carefully. And when I'd gone perhaps another 80 or 100 yards, I thought, well, that's enough down this track, because there's blood splodges every so often. So I retraced my steps, went back to the road, and then sneaked down the side of the road so that I got right up to the buildings, and there was no sign of any movement whatsoever. Returned to the battalion and reported to the major that the buildings appeared to be clear. The following day, or the day after that, the company was then tasked to proceed and take over these buildings, which would then be occupied by an advanced dressing station of the Royal Army Medical Corps, the field ambulance. So we moved down there and moved into them and formed a perimeter around them without incident. But in a dried up stream on the far side of the buildings, tied to a log, the medics found the remains of three Burmans. And retrospectively, it is probably their blood that I'd seen 2 days earlier on the track. Again, it might have been 2 or 3 days earlier, because these three Burmans were very badly decomposed with the heat, and all the medics could do was throw petrol on them and cremate them. So whether there's a connection between them and the blood, I know not. But the blood was fresh enough to put me on red alert, to say the least. We established a perimeter around this advanced dressing station, so we were then approximately half a mile south of the battalion position. And wounded started to come through from other battalions in the division, particularly the 4th Brigade, who were then fighting, 4th and 5th Brigades, who were then fighting in the suburbs of Mandalay, the suburb of Ava, A-V-A, and the southwest corner of Mandalay City itself. Then, in ones, sometimes twos and threes, some 7 or 8 wounded Jap prisoners came in, and they were treated and looked after by the RMC in exactly the same way as our wounded. We, in our platoon headquarters, our platoon and company headquarters, were fairly close together, and some of the Japs were laid on stretchers 12, 15 yards from where we were. And naturally, we had an armed guard on them all the time, round the clock, but they were no trouble at all. One of them had been very badly burnt with flamethrower and was very, very heavily bandaged, with just his lips showing. And whenever he wanted water, he knew the English word for water, he was given it. Some of the other Japs were put in one of the school buildings. And we spent approximately a week there guarding the advanced dressing station, field ambulance. And one evening, a Japanese warrant officer, what they call a socho in their rank structure, had spinal cerebral malaria. I'm no medic, but we recognised the symptoms because he kept babbling and rolling off his stretcher. McGrath, the major's batman, I and others put him back on two or three times, whereupon the poor chap in his delirium babbled and rolled off again. A Jap on a stretcher opposite him looked at me and sat up and went pointing with his hand and tapping his head, meaning that indicating that the poor sergeant major was off his rocker. The Jap then lay back down on the stretcher and moved his arms across his body, indicating for us to tie him down. So we tied him down with bandages. Either the following day or the day after that, most of the Japs were then evacuated and went off in an ambulance to one of the airstrips to be flown to the casualty clearing station at Shuibo. And that Jap who had indicated this to me had obviously appreciated the fact that we treated them humanely. And as the ambulance drove out, I'm very proud to say that Jap sat up on his stretcher and saluted me. I hope he got back to Japan safely to his family after the war.
These would be the first live Japanese you'd really had opportunity to be close to.
Yes.
Did they in any way surprise you in the sense of these were warriors and their condition and the way they reacted to being prisoners?
There was no conversation through obviously the language barrier, but an American senior NCO, an American Japanese senior NCO came and interrogated them, asked them questions. We left him to it, we weren't involved with it, and we showed him some of the photographs that we'd taken from their packs of the Japanese at Mala Jin 3 weeks earlier. And the obviously high-ranking officer in full dress and with his sword, he identified as Colonel Tori Kai, T-O-R-I-K-A-I, commander of the 138 Infantry Regiment of the 31st Japanese Division. The 15th Army consisted of the 15th, 31st and 33rd Japanese Divisions. But at this particular time, we were also hitting stragglers from other units which we didn't identify. Whilst we were covering the field ambulance advanced dressing station, after about the fourth or fifth day, an Anglo-Burman, two Anglo-Burmans, one a Mr. White, came to our company and was received by Major Tony Shuttle, the company commander, and reported that he had walked some 35 miles from a village to the southeast of where we were, that is to say the southeast of Mandalay, probably some 40 miles from Mandalay, about 25 from where we were, called Zawgi, Z-A-W-G-Y-I, where there was a convent manned by British nuns of the Joseph's Order. They had originally been in the main convent in Mandalay City itself, but had been moved out, evacuated by the Japanese to this subsidiary convent in the village of Zawgi, complete with the children who they were educating, that is to say, local children and Christian children and Anglo-Burman and Anglo-Indian children. They were very worried about that withdrawing Japanese passing the village, but particularly hostile Buddhist Burmans, would we arrange for their evacuation to safety. So Colonel Waterhouse tasked C Company and A Company to move from the Mandalay-Rangoon Road, which these school buildings were alongside, and the battalion position. He detached both companies to move across country some 25 miles to Zorgi Convent. We of C Company led the way. We also had with us under command a section of mortars consisting of two detachments under command of the mortar officer, Captain John Rollins. So C Company under Major Tony Shuttle and A Company under Major Sean Kelly moved carefully cross country in the direction of Zorgi Convent, and we staged at through a village of Ebya, E-B-Y-A. A Company remained there holding that because we didn't want to get cut off completely. We needed a strong local position between the Mandalay-Rangoon Road and the convent so that we weren't completely all our eggs in one basket. And we of C Company moved on ahead towards the convent. My platoon were leading, and we moved very, very cautiously in single file, led by Mr. White. And we moved down through various cultivated fields of cotton and whatever, and the odd banana grove, down into a chong. Along the side of the chong, it was about 20 yards wide and again about thigh deep, and then approached the village from the west. It was obvious from the fact that the villages could be seen that there were no enemy in the immediate vicinity. And when we got within a couple of hundred yards of the village, I identified a group of nuns standing outside the door of their church, part of the convent and school complex. And they were wearing the UK black habits of their order. I learnt later this was the reason, because their tropical whites had all got used up and deteriorated during the 3 years since the Japanese invasion, 1941-42. But it struck me that there we were going in armed to the teeth with weapons, but they had stayed there throughout the 3 years of Japanese occupation, fortified by their faith. The villagers welcomed us and thrust tomatoes into our hands, which we ate later and were very, very welcome as fresh fruit, and also sticks of sugar cane, and told us to chew them. But we had more serious work in hand, and that was to get a perimeter round the convent area. It was a large village, mainly Christian, naturally, through the convent being there, and it was obvious from the start that only a battalion could cover the whole village. So for the first night, Major Shuttle concentrated on the convent and school area, and we covered that. A Company remained at Ebya. The first night at Ebya, a large group of Japanese bumped the position, withdrawing from the north, and A Company fired on them, winged one, and he was still there, wounded at first light, and they took him prisoner. He was only the second prisoner. An earlier chap had been captured at when we cut the Mandalay-Rangoon Road, and he was a straggler and wounded, and either A or D Company had taken him as a POW But those two wounded chaps were the only two that we took in 10 months, because it was SOP to kill them before they killed you. We weren't acting out of any form of callousness. It was merely routine. And that was all there was to it. Now, that night at Zorgi Convent, we heard a commotion at the south end of the village, which we were unable to cover. And one hut was set on fire. So we knew that Japs had come into that south end of the village. And as soon as we had stood down after first light on the first morning, I immediately left my platoon sorting themselves out and eating some of their hardtack biscuits and anything else that they had to hand, which was very little. And I went through the village, and from an Anglo-Indian or Anglo-Burman, I learned that the Japanese had come in the south end of the village and had taken away the head man of the next village, who was a Christian and who had left that village and was sheltering in the Zorgi village where he thought he'd be safe. I then walked out to the south side of the village and suddenly heard a tremendous commotion. And about a quarter of a mile away, I saw a group of villagers carrying what appeared to be a body in a chair. And this Anglo-Burman or Anglo-Indian, who I think was a lawyer, Mr. Fernandez, said that it appeared that they'd found this headman. So I dashed back, got two or three men, and Corporal Campbell, and a couple of stretcher bearers with a stretcher, and we rushed out to meet them. And there it was. It was this poor headman of the next village who'd been kidnapped and taken away by the Japanese about half or three quarters of a mile away from the village, flung to the ground and very severely bayoneted out of sheer bloody-mindedness. Some of the bayonet wounds had obviously penetrated his body. Another one had come off his breastbone and shot across his chest and into his arm. And the man was completely unarmed, and all he was clutching was his Holy Rosary. We got him on the stretcher and got him back to company headquarters.
Did you see any other instances of this religious element?
This was only earlier we'd had the chap tied to the tree near Pinjin. We'd had the three tied up to the log across the stream at the school buildings on the side of the Mandalay Rangoon Road. This was the third incident, and absolutely first at first hand. So Corporal Campbell and his medics gave him what limited treatment they could, kept him on the stretcher at company headquarters. With my patrol, I looked around and the Japanese boot marks everywhere, so obviously they were passing through that way on their withdrawal southwards. But I couldn't actually see any of them. They'd obviously flung this chap to the ground, bayoneted him multiple wounds, and then continued their withdrawal southwards. A company joined us, and then it was decided between Major Shuttle and Major Kelly that C Company would pull out that afternoon and stage back through Abia, halfway between Zorgi and the Mandalay Rangoon Road. So we prepared to move out of the village. And C Company went first, and we passed through. We stayed overnight at Ebia, then went back the following day to cover A Company's withdrawal out of Zorgi. with the nuns and the school children. I had had very interesting conversations with the nuns, which I'll come to later on. But the main job now was to get them and the Anglo-Burmans and the Anglo-Indians evacuated by bullock cart and on foot. As I say, the Chong was about 25 yards wide, waist deep. So we said to the nuns, shall we carry you, or do you wish to wade across? One or two of them chose to wade, but one young nun, Sister Aquinas, said to Sean Kelly, you can carry me across. And I must say, he picked the best looker. I said to an older nun, Sister Mary, are you going to wade, or shall I carry you, Sister? And she said, you can carry me. So I picked her up, and we waded across the Chong, whereupon she said, God bless you 100 times, God bless you 1,000,000 times, and words to that effect. I found it both interesting and amusing that probably Sean Kelly and I are two of the very few people in the world who have ever had a nun in their arms. During our 2 nights, 3 days in the Zorgi village, I conversed closely with the Mother Superior, Sister Augustine Joseph, who came from Marseille, Sister Kevin, who was from Limerick, and another nun who had been responsible for 2 British children. The nuns were quite, to some extent, complimentary to the Japanese, who had merely interned them there and did a census every 6 months, a head count of them and their wards, the children. And one of the nuns told me that when the Japanese came to do their 6-monthly census, on one occasion, 2 of the Japanese soldiers had got tagged up on toddy, the rice wine, and were becoming a nuisance to the school children, whereupon the Japanese officer fell them in, stood them attention, gave them one hell of a beating, and when they fell to the ground, proceeded to put the boot in as well. So there was no more trouble from that quarter. And it may well have been the same officer, but when checking the nominal roll, he had an Indian clerk, Tamil or whatever, writing it down in English. And he asked the nationality of the 2 children for which this nun was responsible for. And bound by her order and her faith, her religion, she declined to lie and said British. And this Japanese officer paused, then turned to the clerk and said Anglo-Indian. So there would be no knock-on effect from that. And they were unanimous in the fact that they feared the Buddhist Burmans, as they called them, more than the withdrawing Japanese. But it was well to get them out. We took the wounded headman along with us, but sadly, before he reached Ebia, the staging post village, he was dead through shock, hemorrhage, and constantly bumping around in the jeep ambulance. But we had no light aircraft or helicopters in those days to come and medevac them, which would have been the order of the day today. And then staging through Ebia, where we'd left our holding party, we then gathered them up, and A&C companies returned to the Mandalay Rangoon Road and handed over our charges, the nuns and the Anglo-Burman civilians and the school children. And they would eventually be taken over by the civil affairs and returned to the main St. Joseph's Convent in Mandalay City. I corresponded with Sister Augustine Joseph after the war. I wrote to Alexandria and Malta on behalf of a very old nun called Sister Mary of the Sacred Heart. I wrote to Limerick for Sister Kevin, and I wrote to Birmingham or Manchester for Sister Aquinas, to their relatives to say that they were safe and well, and I got replies to all four letters. And whilst on a short holiday in Malta, 30 to 40 years ago, I saw the Josephine Convent, asked about it, and our guide said that she actually knew Sister Kevin, who was still alive at that time, but she was as tough as old boots, and I think still going strong.